express train should be one of the most dangerous ways of travelling invented by man. It weighs more than 500 tons, and at more than 100 miles an hour, it won't stop in less than a mile, and it's virtually unchangeable in its course. Yet, to be in a compartment of a British passenger train is statistically one of the safest ways of travelling. This is a film about how, against all the odds, it's been achieved. Rail travel is safe because, for almost 150 years, railway operators and engineers have striven to develop a system of safeguards which is really foolproof. Each time it's broken down, then they've sorted through the wreckage to see why. After each serious accident, there are inquiries held by the officers of the Railway Inspectorate. Independent of the old companies or British Rail, their inquiries find out how, why, and what went wrong, with all the meticulous detail of a law court. Then they suggest how the system should be changed to stop it happening again. It's a process of safeguards, catastrophe, then more safeguards. More and faster trains then put a greater strain on the system. Another crash then squeezes through a new loophole. As speeds rise, it will inevitably happen again. The worst crash ever happened here on the main line from London to Scotland on May the 22nd, 1915. The battle for Gallipoli was being fought when on 227 epitaphs was written this name. At Quintin's Hill were, and still are, two loops on either side of the main lines. In the loops, two goods trains were already parked when a slow local passenger train arrived. That morning, as they'd often done on other mornings, it was shunted back through the crossover onto the wrong side of the road to let a sleeper express overtake it and roar on towards Scotland. Then a troop train heading for Liverpool ran head-on into the front of the local train. A second sleeper express heading for Scotland ran into the wreckage. The troop train, 213 yards long, was reduced in an instant to only 67 yards, and the gas cylinders for the carriage lamps exploded to set ablaze a funeral pyre. James Dawson, an eyewitness, said, from all parts, bodies without heads, arms and legs protruded. Most of the casualties were among the 7th Royal Scots in the troop train. Up to that moment, they'd been going to Gallipoli. Not one private soldier went. Only Colonel Peebles and 6 officers sailed from Liverpool. Only after 23 hours were the fires put out. Throughout that day and the next, a 17-year-old lamp boy from the Quintin's Hill box worked to save what could be saved. His name was Michael Moscrop.
Just about here, it was where I assisted our local joiner, Robert Kirkpatrick, to amputate a man's leg who was fixed under a wheel of one of the trains with an ordinary joiner's saw.
The carnage was here on these tracks, but to see why it happened, we must follow through a series of broken rules and mistaken actions in the signal box. To this day, the box is virtually unchanged. It was always known as a sociable box, and the first rule that was broken was almost a Quintin's Hill tradition. By the rules, only 2 signalmen should have been here, but 3 other railwaymen were sitting round the fire.
The morning papers had just arrived off the local train, and no doubt they were discussing the Gallipoli situation, because We were in the throes of that at the time. And no doubt there'd be a lot of conversation going on in the box at the time, and it was just human error.
It wasn't only that the buzz of conversation distracted the signalman, for by the rules, the fireman of the local train waiting on the main line should have walked to the box to check for himself that the lever of the signal protecting his train was blocked with a simple mechanical reminder. It was established at the inquiry that he did come to the box. Indeed, to prove he'd obeyed the rules, he signed the register. But that was all he did. He didn't check the lever. Finally, having blocked the line going south, the signalman should have used his telegraph to warn the next box along. Then he wouldn't even have been offered the troop train. It would have been held quite normally several miles to the north. But he didn't send that signal. And so, in a moment of forgetfulness, with the local in full view only 60 yards away and five experienced railwaymen in the box, one of the signalmen, and it's not clear which, pulled this fatal lever.
So the worst accident in the world happened not because the system failed, but because, quite simply, somebody forgot. Mistakes, confusion, errors of judgment, these may be normal and acceptable in almost every other field. Only in railways do they have such dire results. But simple human error is apparently inevitable. Human nature has, after all, an almost infinite capacity for making mistakes. And for this reason, it's been necessary to invent a system which recognizes that mistakes will occur, yet tries to prevent their awful consequences. To be safe, it seems, the system must be able to override human folly. A signalman about to press the wrong button must be warned by the system, be careful. Now, with all our modern technical wizardry, this sort of thing is quite possible. But before, in earlier days, the checks were, to say the least, rudimentary.
Rules and regulations for the conduct of the traffic and for the guidance of officers and men in the service of the London and Northwestern Railway Company.
Special trains or engines have frequently to be run without previous notice of any kind. It is therefore necessary for the staff along the line to be at all times prepared for extra trains or engines.
Professor Charles Babbage, an early railway experimenter, drove one of these special engines. He told a story that showed how casual the controls were. One day he arrived at Paddington to be told that there was an obstruction on the line out of London, but that the other line was empty and he could go out the wrong way, as it were, on that. After checking the authority for this bending of the rules, he sent for his engine, only to be told it wasn't quite ready. As he waited, he heard a distant train, and sure enough, an engine came happily steaming into the station. It had come in on the line he should have been going out on. It was the eccentric engineer, Brunel. He told Babbage he'd found this engine at Slough and had driven all the way at 50 miles an hour. Babbage asked what Brunel would have done had he met another engine, Babbage's, coming to meet him at 40 miles an hour on the same line. Brunel thought for a moment and then said,
I would have put on all steam I could command with a view to driving off the opposite engine by the superior velocity of my own.
On Brunel's Great Western, like most of the companies, at first train movements were controlled by men called policemen standing by the track. They were equipped with a watch and three hand signals. After a train passed, for the first 10 minutes they signaled stop. Then for 7 more minutes, caution. And then finally, all clear. Theoretically, the trains should have been at least 10 minutes apart, assuming they all ran at the same speed and didn't break down round the corner. But they often did break down, and with no communication along the line, disaster followed. Obviously, what they needed was a way in which a policeman could ask his mate next up the line whether a particular train had cleared the intervening section of track. It came with the telegraph. It arrived in 1841. It hadn't got much of a vocabulary, but it was the first step towards the modern system. With it came an array of fixed signals. Together, signals and the telegraph had the potential to keep trains apart. Now you could check that the line really was clear before you signaled a train on. But that wasn't the way it happened, and they went on regulating trains by the clock. Theoretically, they used railway time, but it tended to vary from station to station. And what's more, with trains going at different speeds, it could be a dangerous business travelling under what was called time interval working. The answer was block working, and spacing in distance, not time. It involved dividing the track into sections, each with its own signal. Telegraph messages from box to box now controlled the trains. If one has to stop, then the next signal back holds a second train. Now, not until the section is really clear can another train go into it. Space block working is a cornerstone of the modern system, but it was to be a very long battle before the wisdom of it was accepted. The first two sections were set up in 1841. Both were in tunnels, one in Derbyshire and the other at Clayton, just outside Brighton, where the line runs under the South Downs. At Clayton, two signalmen, one at each end of the tunnel, controlled signals that told a train whether or not it was safe to enter. The trains themselves automatically reset the signals to danger as they passed. The two boxes were connected by telegraph instruments that could pass simple messages about whether trains were in the tunnel or not. Saturday, the 25th of August, 1861, Brighton Station was crowded with holidaying Victorians. Extra excursion trains had been arranged by the company, the old London to Brighton line, and the timetable was so crowded that three trains were due to leave with only 14 minutes between them. They left with only 7 minutes between them, and by the time they'd climbed the gradient to Clayton, they caught each other up even more. The first train went into the tunnel only 3 minutes ahead of the second. Once the signalman had watched it into the tunnel, he signalled train in tunnel to his colleague. Then he noticed to his dismay that the train's passing had failed to set the signal to danger, and the next train was fast approaching. Frantically, he tried to work the signal by hand, but in vain, and as a last desperate measure, he seized his red flag. So, against his wishes, the second train disappeared into the tunnel. Now, he was in the last hours of a 24-hour shift, and he wasn't thinking very clearly, so he did the obvious thing. Once again, he sent off train in tunnel to his colleague. Now he was left with a problem. Had the driver of the second train seen his flag or not? There was no obvious way of telling what was happening in the tunnel, but at least one good thing had happened. This time, the automatic resetting of the signal had worked, so the third train stopped. Now the flustered and very tired signalman had to decide whether or not he could release it. The question he needed to telegraph was, is second train out of tunnel? But the equipment couldn't ask that, and so he signaled, is tunnel clear? When he got the answer, train out of tunnel, he reckoned that the second train had got through safely, despite his attempt to stop it, and so he flagged on the third train. The driver of the second train had seen the red flag and had stopped his train. He'd then begun to reverse back to the box to ask what was the matter. The tunnel clear signal had come from the other box because at that moment a train was leaving the tunnel, but it was the first train, not this one. 23 people had died and 176 were seriously injured. But the inspecting officer, Captain Sir Henry Tyler, argued that despite the Clayton Tunnel accident, continuous space block working, coupled with the telegraph, was still the safest way to run a railway. In their report, the inspectorate fought for its use. John Chester Craven of the railway company disagreed.
My board state frankly that they still feel the telegraphic system of working will augment rather than diminish the risk of accidents.
Today's chief inspecting officer, Colonel Robertson, still feels strongly about space working.
We fought to obtain this for many, many years, and we finally won. But in winning it, we had to meet and overcome a great deal of antagonism from the railway companies, some of whom were extreme laggards in adopting space interval working, but some of them adopted it fairly quickly.
The laggards didn't finally give in until 30 years after Clayton. The equipment was too expensive, they said. In the meantime, other battles were fought, and Colonel Yolland, another inspector, suggested a major improvement after an accident in 1874. A goods train arrived in Bowness South Sidings with wagons for the North Sidings. It was held there to let an express through on its way from Edinburgh to Glasgow. Then, although a second express was due in 5 minutes, the goods train was shunted across. It should have been protected by the signals, but it wasn't, because the second express, running 10 to first, crashed into it to kill the driver and 16 passengers. There obviously had to be a system by which the signals and points were linked in some way. Interlocked Together said that if the points were set against the main line, then the signals couldn't be cleared for that line. In the frame room beneath the signal box in Victorian ironmongery, this system now appeared. The signals and point levers were interconnected by horizontal bars. A complicated system of slots and notches then automatically arranged things so that a signal couldn't be pulled clear unless the points were already set for the route it controlled. In addition, there were separate locking levers. These you had to remember to pull, but then they thrust a metal bar through part of the signal mechanism.
It's the beginning of a system of intelligent levers that won't let you make a mistake. Up to this point in the history of railways, the emphasis had been mainly concentrated on getting rid of human error. But now the emphasis starts to shift to the machinery. But if you're going to put safety in the hands of the machinery, then you've got to make sure that the apparatus itself doesn't fail.
In the evolution of the railways, when a train passed, the first thing a signalman would do was to immediately reset his signals to danger. When the train reached the next section, the signalman there sent back the signal for train out of section. Once he'd got this signal, a signalman, and this is the important thing, would then, as a routine, set his signals back to clear, even if nothing was coming. And that was the cause of a disaster on a snowy night in January 1876 at Abbots Ripton in Huntingdonshire. The Flying Scotsman had crashed into a coal train, and a second express had ploughed into the wreckage. The machinery of the signal itself had failed. At danger, the signal arms stuck out quite normally at horizontal, but this wasn't their usual position. For most of the time, they were at clear. A and when they were at clear, the arm dropped down into a slot.
Captain Tyler's inquiry showed that the signal arms had frozen inside the signal posts and that they weren't showing danger when they should have done.
With the arms normally at down, the poor signalman suddenly found all his signals immovably frozen at clear.
One of the fundamental principles, if not the fundamental principle, of all railway working is that all safety devices must fail safe.
This fail-safe idea was clearly spelt out in Captain Tyler's report, but it was far from being the accepted gospel that it is today. That didn't come until after an accident in 1889 at Armagh in Ireland. A train had stopped on an embankment and had to be divided. Because at this time brakes were pulled on by a vacuum, as soon as the pipes were disconnected, the back half of the train was left with no workable brakes and ran back down the hill to hit an oncoming train. By simply reversing the system, holding the brakes off by vacuum, they became fail-safe. Damage to the pipes then caused the vacuum to disappear and so put on the brakes.
The Armagh accident gave rise at once, within a year, to legislation by which the inspecting officers got the three things that they had been fighting for so long. That is, a proper system of space interval and not time interval, interlocking between signals and points, and continuous automatic brakes.
The new legislation of the 1889 Act was the first major piece of railway law. But it came too late to prevent an accident on the Great Western at Norton Fitzwarren in 1890. A coal train had finished shunting, and the signalman put it to wait on the wrong side of the road, the near side, while on the far side a fast goods went through. When the goods train had passed, the signalman from a neighbouring box offered the Norton Fitzwarren signalman a broad-gauge express from the other direction, and he cheerfully accepted it, forgetting about the coal train. Passengers were killed and nine injured. The signalman admitted that he'd simply forgotten the coal train. He'd not been feeling well since being knocked down by a light engine, and on this particular day he'd been bad in the head, worse than usual. Apart from the danger of a sick man being in charge of a signal box, the central point about the organization of a safe railway comes out yet again from this accident. Simple forgetfulness is inevitable and produces tragedies. The inspecting officer made some useful suggestions about how a signalman's memory could be jogged. The first was a simple mechanical reminder. A metal collar which would physically stop a lever being pulled to clear. This was the origin of the collar that was to be forgotten 25 years later at Quintin's Hill. Another rule which came in soon afterwards and was also forgotten at Quintin's Hill was the blocking back rule, that if your stretch of line was obstructed, you must notify the signal box in the rear so that they couldn't even offer you another train.
I shall have to keep you there a few minutes, driver.
All right, Frank, I'll come over.
Then what was called Rule 55, which said that if a train was stopped by a signal, the driver must whistle, and if the signal was not lowered in 3 minutes in clear weather or immediately in snow or fog, then somebody had to go to the signal box to make sure that the proper precautions had been taken. Again, this was to be the third rule broken a quarter of a century later at Quintin's Hill.
This one, ours, is it?
Yeah. Number 17, Leroy, that's first.
Despite its obvious good sense, the rule about collars was not accepted by all the companies.
Busy these days?
For example, the Midland Railway didn't use them, even in a complicated box, like Hawes Junction. Hawes Junction is a very bleak spot up in the Pennines. It was also a very busy spot, since the trains needed extra engines to help them up the hills. At Hawes, all these extra engines were turned and sent down again. Late on Christmas Eve 1910, the signalman was handling no fewer than five extra engines, as well as a busy program of express trains. After turning one pair of engines, he parked them on the main line while he turned a second pair. Then, without collars to remind him, he forgot the first two waiting on the main line and set his signals to clear for an express to Scotland. It was the two forgotten engines that had been waiting behind the signal which set off, quite naturally assuming that it had been cleared for them. Their departure went unnoticed by the signalman. Without realizing what had happened, the signalman went quietly about his business, leaving the signals set for the speeding express coming up behind. It was traveling much faster, in the same direction, and on the same tracks as the two light engines. Signalman Sutton was still completely oblivious to the danger, even when a driver who had seen what had happened from one of the other engines on the turntable came to the signal box to warn him.
What have you done with these two engines for Carlisle?
They've gone to Carlisle.
Not like you think they haven't. When you pulled off the express, them two engines were standing behind the starter, waiting for it to come off. And when it came off, they went.
The first thing Sutton could do to check was to ring Benjamin Bellis in the next signal box.
Ben, where's them two light engines I sent on?
You haven't given me out.
Has the down express arrived yet?
There's been nout come.
Bike. The express will be into them.
The down express is railwayman's language for an express going away from London. In this case, the one following the two light engines.
Have you seen out?
No, not through yet.
Did you see him go when I pulled off for the express?
Oh, they went all right.
Ben, has anything arrived yet?
No, not yet.
Will you go to Station Master Bunce and tell him I'm afraid I've wrecked the Scotch Express?
He had indeed wrecked the Scotch Express. It wasn't entirely his fault. The engine drivers hadn't obeyed the new Rule 55, and the company didn't believe in signal collars. It encouraged carelessness in the signalman, they said. As was to happen 5 years later at Quintin's Hill, gas cylinders had exploded, and in moments the whole wreck had caught fire, and 12 people had died. Apart from underlining the idiocy of the company towards collars, the main thing that came from this accident was a push forward for a new device. The inspecting officer felt that because of the complex engine movements here, the stretch should be track-circuited. This was an American device used in the States since the 1880s, but it was only just coming into this country. Each section or block of track was electrically insulated from its neighbor. From a battery, an electric current ran along one rail, through an instrument, and back down the other rail. When a train came into the section, the current short-circuited through its metal wheels and axles and so never reached the instrument. Without the current, the instrument moved over to a new reading. Now, by looking at your instruments, you could see if there was something on your section. It was a big step towards making it very difficult for a signalman to forget. While these advances were making double track working safer, even more rigorous systems had been worked out for single lines. It was often said that single line working was safer once you'd avoided the risk of two trains running into the same stretch of line from opposite directions. It all had to be carefully planned so that trains passed at stations where there were double lines. To avoid trains being sent to meet each other between the stations, Edward Tyre, a great signal engineer, had invented his tablet system. On his system, an engine driver could only enter a single line section if he had a token, the tablet, that gave him the right to enter that particular stretch of track. At each end of a section, there was an instrument into which the tablets fitted. The two instruments were electrically interlocked, so that a tablet could only be taken out by the simultaneous cooperation of operators at both ends of the section. In this way, each end could hardly avoid knowing what the other was doing. Like collars, this system was only a formalized memory jogger. It took no responsibility, but simply helped the human actors to play their parts more accurately. It had worked well for something like 40 years until January 1921, 9 years after Tyre's death. Two trains were approaching Abermule Station on the borders of Wales, an express and a stopping train. If one or other had been late, then they'd have passed at the next station along. The tablet instruments were in the station buildings, and although only the signalman and station master were by the rules allowed to operate them, in practice they were worked by any of the station staff. On this particular day, it was the signalman who, quite legally, went down to the apparatus to allow the signalman at Montgomery, the station to the north of Abermule, to take a tablet from his instrument and so let the slow train come on towards Abermule. He then went off to set the points for this first train. While he was doing this, the only people in the station buildings within earshot of the Abermule tablet instruments were a young porter and a boy. Neither of them had permission to work the instruments. Nevertheless, when Newtown, the next station to the south, sent the signal to ask permission to send up the other train, the express from the opposite direction, the young porter broke the rules and went off to operate the instrument that let the Newtown signalman take out a tablet at the other end. Now the instruments show trains approaching Abermule from both directions, but so far so good, for the track divides here to let them pass. The porter went off to set his points. Nobody told anybody anything, but the instruments showed what was happening, and because they were electrically interlocked, nobody could get another tablet out before a tablet from one of the two trains was returned. The first train to arrive was the stopping train, and out came the boy, breaking the rules again, to take the tablet from the driver. He intended to change it for the one for the next section, which, of course, he could not have done until the instrument was unlocked, with the tablet from the express at present occupying that line. At this point, the story becomes confused. The boy, it seems, met the station master, who'd been busy in the goods yard, and said something like, "You take this, and I'll collect the tickets," whereupon he passed the tablet over. Railwaymen are always impatient to get trains on their way, and so, assuming that today the trains were to pass at the next station, the station master made the crucial mistake. Not realizing which tablet he'd got, and without checking what was written on it, he just accepted that it was for the next section, and simply passed it back to the driver who had brought it.
All right.
Yes, sir.
Even now, the system should have failed safe. By the rules, the driver should have checked that the tablet was the right one for this section, but he didn't, and he set off from Abermule for Newtown, with, as his authority, the tablet for the previous section. Only when the boy went to the tablet room to give the train entering section signal did anyone realize, too late, the terrible mistake they'd made. The local train went through the points and onto the same track as the approaching express. pictures taken 50 years ago show that a series of trivial human errors were able to defeat a most ingenious mechanical device. The engine men of the stopping train were instantly crushed by the heavier locomotive of the express. The boiler of the express was torn clean from its frame, but its crew survived. 15 passengers were killed, and 26 more were injured.
The inspector suggested that the tablet instruments should be interlocked with the signals, so that unless the correct tablet was out, it would be impossible to give the signal to start. This interlocking of apparatus, so that things can only be done in the correct order and in the correct way, was not only vital for single line working, it became the cornerstone of the system of control of all rail movements. By this stage of the story, the machinery is beginning to look fairly foolproof. What with the signals and points locked automatically against the moves of a mistaken signalman, it begins to look as though the chances of an accident happening are very slim. But then came one accident which showed how, if there was the slightest possibility of an accident happening, then happen it eventually will. There are just so many signals, so many trains, so many possibilities, that sooner or later, the million-to-one chance comes up.
Outside this station, the million-to-one chance came up. It's Hull Paragon Station, as it is now. But early on the morning of St. Valentine's Day, 1927, the situation was just the same. A train was leaving the station at almost the precise moment that another was due to arrive from the opposite direction. The signalmen in the box were hurrying. One was looking after the signals for the departing train, while another was ready to set the points for the arrival as soon as he could. The actual setting for the accident involved a signal on this massive gantry and a set of points in the midst of this complicated mesh of tracks. It came out at the inquiry that the signalman looking after the departing train had mistakenly returned signal 171 to stop fractionally early before the last coaches of the train had passed it. At that precise moment, the other signalman pulled over point lever 95. It was the inevitable human error. What he'd actually intended to do was pull number 96, the lever behind. The two mistakes reinforced each other in a seemingly impossible way. Taking the action slowly, this is what happened. The signal controlling the departing train was number 171. When it was reset, the interlocking between it and point lever 95 was freed. However, when the engine reached the points, another device protected it. It's called a locking bar and prevents you moving the points when a train is already on them. Normally, the points were continuously protected because the engine reached the locking bar before the resetting of the signal freed the interlocking. But on this occasion, because signal 171 was reset early, there was a gap. For 1.9 seconds, the points were unprotected. In that 1.9 seconds, they accidentally pulled the only lever that could produce disaster. To pull it took 1.6 seconds, and incredibly, the 1.6 had fitted into the 1.9. Two trains met just opposite the local hospital, and to take the injured through, they knocked a hole in the hospital wall. The new brickwork, now 45 years old, is still visible. It is an insignificant memorial to the 12 dead, but it's a reminder of the extraordinary degree of safety you need to run a railway.
Despite the accident at Hull, by now the signal system and the signalman's errors are the lesser cause of accidents. But another hazard is beginning to show up, error by the train driver. But the principle is the same, recognition that the mistakes will happen, and yet for the equipment somehow to prevent their disastrous consequences.
So far, the GWR had done most to help the driver, yet almost 50 years to the day after the disaster at Norton Fitzwarren, another tragedy happened there. It was a November night in 1940 at the height of the London Blitz. The bombs had just stopped falling as the 9:50 p.m. train to Penzance made its way out of London. Driver Stacey's own home in Acton had been bombed the night before, and wartime disruptions had made his train an hour late before it got to Taunton. Now, trains stopping at Taunton are diverted onto the relief lines alongside the platforms, so the main lines can carry through trains straight up the centre. On restarting, there are two alternatives. The stopping trains are normally switched immediately back onto the main line. Alternatively, and less often, they're held on the relief line for 4 miles until after they've passed through Norton Fitzwarren station. There, the relief line ends, and they're switched back onto the main line. That evening, when the Penzance train was about to leave, at first the signalman signalled it straight back onto the main line, and then changed his mind, because a fast newspaper train was coming up behind, and he reset its signals for the relief line. When driver Stacey actually left, he thought he was to be routed back in the normal way to the main line, while in fact he was kept to the left on the relief, so the paper train could overtake. Mistakenly, he checked the signals to his right, all set to green for the fast paper train. He should have been checking signals to his left. He kept going at full speed, and then, just before the relief line ended, this happened. Stacey had gone straight off the end of the relief line. 27 died. The position of the signals, the inspector implied, was confusing, but the essence of it was the driver's mistake. Stacey never forgot it. He said, "Don't talk to me, I'm a murderer." A year later, he died for no apparent medical reason.
The inspector's point about non-standardization of the positioning of signals wasn't acted upon immediately because it was wartime. Later, after the war, nationalization meant that standards had to be worked out nationally. And by then, what's called four-aspect color light signaling seemed to be the system with most to recommend it.
Slowly, since nationalisation, colour light signalling has spread throughout the network. It's not universal yet, but one day it will be. It's based on a green light for go. In what's called the four-aspect version, a double yellow means go easy, you may have to slow down. A single yellow means you will have to slow down because the next signal is at present red. Of course, it may change so that you don't actually have to stop. The important thing is that the system gives you more information than did the old semaphores. Now you get 2 warnings before a red, not just one. What's more, by standardizing the height and position of the signals, they're easier to read.
Now we're very near the present, and 2 names tend to stick in people's recent memory. Harrow in 1952 and Lewisham in 1957. Both were, like Norton Fitzwarren, in the new group of driver errors.
St. John's is near Lewisham, and the accident there, like Harrow, was caused by a driver passing a series of signals set against him. The 202 deaths in these 2 accidents underlined in a most tragic way the need for some sort of aid for the driver to bring the state of a signal forcefully to his attention. After Lewisham, public opinion and the inspectors wanted all lines to have an automatic warning system like the one the GWR had invented way back in 1906. That was part mechanical, part electric, and operated by ramps in the middle of the track. When an engine passed a signal, underneath it there was an electrically conducting shoe that made contact with the ramp. Now the signal, the ramp, and the engine are electrically connected. With a signal at danger, a siren sounded in the cab. If the driver still refused to pay attention, then the brakes were automatically put on, and everything was slowly brought to a halt. If it was quite clear to the driver that the system had gone wrong, then he had an override switch to cancel everything out. This system was in the engine that crashed at Norton Fitzwarren, where the driver must have used the cancel switch several times. It underlines the danger that cancelling can become too automatic. On the southern region, traffic is so dense and trains follow each other so closely that in peak hours they're frequently running on yellow, not green signals. The conventional warning system would be hooting so constantly that cancelling its continuous cries of wolf would be totally automatic, and then its function as an aid to the driver is lost. On the Southampton to Bournemouth line, there's a new prototype system that not only warns a driver as he passes an adverse signal, but also brings every signal right into the cab. With a green, you don't need to do anything. But with a yellow or double yellow, you have to accept the signal by cancelling the warning. If the driver's a bit inattentive and makes the inevitable error, like pressing for a double yellow when he should have accepted a single, then the system takes over and puts on the brakes. That device might have saved the Lewisham or Harrow drivers, but things have moved on since then, and the British Rail Research Department is near perfecting another piece of equipment that should give a driver everything he could possibly want. Trackside cabinets hold information about the track ahead, speed limits, gradients, distance between signals, even temporary restrictions. All this, together with the immediate state of the signals, is fed down to the track. Detectors under the train can then pick it all up by a totally electronic system from two wires between the track. A mini computer works it all out. All the driver's got to do is to read the computer's conclusion off a dial. It shows him how fast he's going, the maximum speed he may do, and warns him of future changes. Although the driver can see a green signal ahead, there's another at red, well out of sight. Although he can't see it, the machinery can. And now the target speed drops to zero. The stray green disc is a fault. He brakes as the signal gets nearer. His maximum allowed speed falls as the computer compares his distance from the signal with this train's braking abilities. If the driver chooses to ignore the computer and doesn't slow down enough so that his speed is above the safe maximum, then he's told off in no uncertain terms. If he persists, then the brakes are put on automatically. Even if the driver did nothing at all, then the train would still stop before the red signal. This is no longer an automatic warning system, but automatic train control. Now he must still obey the old established principle and observe Rule 55, but without moving from his comfortable seat.
This is the driver of the 1120, former Central to Waterloo.
It's the same two wires between the tracks that are carrying his telephone conversation.
Wait for the aspect to change. Thank you very much.
That system has been designed not only to help the driver cope with a high density of trains, but also to cope with very high speed. These devices are for the future. For the moment, we are here. A 2,750 horsepower diesel brings an intercity into Bristol Temple Meads, a station that still retains some of Brunel's original structure. Tucked away around a corner is a very non-Brunel style building.
from Weston, leaving at 14:15 for Paddington.
In it is the latest version of everything that we've seen developing. These signalmen control 117 miles of track from Bath to Weston-super-Mare and beyond. For Templemead station alone, there used to be two complete boxes, 700 levers, and several men. Now it's these 35 switches within the reach of one man. You set the 21 points for a train to pass through these 2.5 miles of track like this. As miles away, the points electrically click over, the route lights turn to yellow. When the train arrives, they'll change to red. It looks like an eccentric millionaire's train set. It's not. That flick of the lights represents several thousand horsepower and a train full of people. The equipment is modern. The principles are embedded in history. A magnetic version of the collar invented in 1890 and missing at Quintin's Hill protects a blocked line. The signalmen constantly take calls under the 80-year-old Rule 55. The interlocking between signals and points that came in after the Bowness accident in 1874 is no longer in a cobwebby cast-iron frame room, but in a temperature-controlled, fluorescently lit switch room filled with banks and banks of electric relays. This sort of signal box is a long way from the red and white flags of the old Brighton line or the Creighton Tunnel disaster. For the moment, this is the end product of a struggle for safety that's been going on for 150 years. But it isn't the final solution. As train speeds rise to 125 miles an hour and then 150 miles an hour that British Rail are aiming at, presumably rare accidents will go on happening. And then the system will change again and move even closer to total infallibility. Nowadays, in a place like this, they reckon to work to an accuracy of 1 in 10 million. 1 in a million, for them, is 10 times too dangerous. And remember, you're about 200 times safer in a train than you are in your car.